From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Several thresholds have been reached in relations between Russia and China, the two Eurasian powers. The opening of some major pipelines and bridge infrastructure between the two, and the imposition of sanctions by China upon some U.S. NGOs were reported in China's and Russia's media on Monday. For more on that, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, analyst based in Moscow, from Moscow via Skype on Monday. Pipelines, bridges, irrelevant acts that seem designed to drive Russia and China into each other's arms out of Washington. I don't know where you want to start, but the strategic partnership that was announced back in 2014 between Russia and China seems to be getting more and more mortar and brick added to it day by day as a consequence of Washington's actions. You want to discuss what's happening there?
Yeah, this week saw two very big events that might have slipped by you in the news cycle. And the first one was a bridge has opened after several years of construction between Russia and China over the Amur River. And this is the first bridge to open between the two countries that will allow for regular vehicle transit. Of course, you know, not only tourists and such going back and forth, but the big thing is going to be trucking. There is simultaneously another bridge project for trains connecting the same area. This is Russia and China actually have a fairly small border, at least with the size of the Russian Far East. And it is over extremely harsh terrain for the most part. This is over the frozen Amur, river, mountains, in winter, right now in the area, it is minus 33 degrees Celsius.
Baby.
Yeah. So, but this, the bridge is the first important thing, and it connects the Russian town of Blagoveshchensk with the Chinese city of Hehe. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but actually it took several decades for, since this was first proposed and the dialogue started and the plans, Putin finally sat down and said, let's build this thing in 2016. And suddenly here it is. It is just another a physical symptom of the growing connections between Russia and China, the Sino-Russian condominium that Western geopoliticians fear so much. Yep. And have tried for years to dismiss, Russia and China are natural rivals, China is about to invade Russia over Siberia because they need land for their billion people and want resources and all the like. And the exact opposite, of course, has been happening over the last few decades.
Right.
And the trepidation in the halls of Brussels and Washington is growing daily, watching these things happen. In fact, seeing this bridge the pipelines that we'll discuss next coming up, article I read out of Washington called it Washington's December Nightmare.
Yeah, we're talking almost 10,000 kilometers worth of pipelines, 9,000 and change. My God, that's about 6,500 miles or something, right? So which means it's like a round trip around the United, across the United States. That's massive.
Yeah. This is the second news. Over the same location, right, coming over the same location, is the Power of Siberia gas pipeline. Now, Russia already pipes oil to China. But gas is kind of a different beast, and it took a few years for the negotiations for this to be completed. They were completed in 2014, and already the pipeline is finished. And this is Putin has called it. I haven't seen statistics to back it up, but he called it the largest construction project in the world. And it stretches some 1,860 miles just on the Russian side.
Right, that's right.
Just on the Russian side. And on the Chinese side, it connects up with their pipeline and will be able to, their whole pipeline network, and will be able to deliver gas all the way through China right to Shanghai. So this is essentially a cross-Eurasian continent pipeline. From northern Siberia all the way down through Russia, northern China, right to the Chinese coastal cities, where production and industry is.
And a lot and of one other reasons. Also, Russian coastal city also. I mean, it goes from Kovikton and Chayandin in Siberia all the way down to Vladivostok. That's about 4,000 kilometers or about 1,800 miles, 1,900 miles. And then you got 5,100 kilometers in North China's, what is it, Heilongjiang province to Shanghai in the east. It's like another, that's as big as crossing the United States.
Yes. And the pipeline, this is really just the first pipeline, of course. This is the thing. But this pipeline will be carrying some 38 billion cubic meters of gas. That's 1.3 trillion cubic feet annually from Russia to China. Russia is set very quickly within the next decade to become China's largest gas producer off of this. It's a big deal. The price that was worked out, will be floating like it is the deals that Russia works out with Europe. It will float according to the price of oil, somewhat following, lagging behind, but it will be connected with that. But more than that, this is more than an economic deal, and it is a big economic deal with this infrastructure, these roads, these trains, these pipelines. In the next few years, trade between Russia and China is set to double, and it's already over $100 billion annually, and most of that is on the Russian side. It's a trade surplus for Russia.
You know, one of the biggest salespeople on this project, by the way, just basically helping to close the negotiations that had been going on for years between Russia and China over natural gas, was the Obama administration. By attacking both Russia and China simultaneously, if you'll recall, around the time of the uprising, quote-unquote, the coup in Kiev, the United States had started to push Russia back or attempt to push Russia back and out of that with beginning all kinds of drilling of the military on Russia's borders going from the Baltics to Korea. At the same time, they decided they were going to teach the Chinese what the South China Sea really meant and who it belonged to, and they started having military drills there. Which resulted in, I think it was May, April or May of 2014, this announcement by President Xi that there was a strategic partnership, and also the announcement, because the U.S. imposed sanctions on Russia at the time that they started trying to bully them both militarily, with China saying, you know what, we're going to do some business with Russia, this is a good time to put together the largest natural gas deal in history, and sat down and negotiated it, and that came out, if I remember, May or June of 2014.
Not only that, think about this. Not only was the deal signed, but this pipeline was constructed while the U.S. and its allies are actively conducting an economic war, sanctioning both Russia and China.
Right. They started in September of 2014. They started in 2014, September.
So the financing, the companies involved, this all was signed, sealed, completed, and delivered.
Yep.
Despite, and even, I think you're right, because of U.S. Sanctions, this heavy-handed economic warfare. And Russia, and the U.S. is scared of Russian pipelines. And then this isn't the only one.
Right.
Because Turkstream, where Russia will deliver natural gas to Turkey, is due to come online in January, in just over a month. And Putin and Erdogan will be on hand to sign that. Turkey badly depends on Russian natural gas to meet its energy needs. And this pipeline will help secure that and more into the future.
Right.
And Nord Stream 2 is due to be completed next year.
That's right.
That will be the second undersea pipeline directly connecting Russia with Germany, which intends to act as the hegemonic energy hub,
right,
doling out energy to the rest of Europe through its networks. And that's kind of funny because Germany specifically stopped a South Stream pipeline going from Russia to southern Europe. Why? Because they want to be the one doling out the supply of Russian energy to the rest of Europe.
Right.
And this has met huge opposition. The U.S. the Congress has already passed in the initial readings. It's it being held up in committee, and no one knows if it'll ever be put forward. But Congress has put forward bills to sanction European companies who work on this project, because of course it is a joint project. I mean, Gazprom has the lead, but German companies are involved in it and have shares in it, and companies from all over Europe, because this is Europe's energy supply.
Right.
And one of the reasons why China, why Europe, why all these countries want Russian natural gas by pipeline, first of all, is gas over coal. Duh. Coal is dirty. Coal, first of all, in terms of climate change, and second of all, just in terms of air pollution.
Right.
Chinese cities are as they ramp up and become the product, as they became the production center for the world, with the West shifting all of their production and pollution to China for the consumer goods, you know, that they consume. Chinese cities have gotten terrible environmental conditions in the air, and the Chinese government has launched big projects to change this.
Right.
And this is a big part of their plan to switch away from coal in China. I mean, it's going to be a phased project.
Right.
It's not going to happen overnight.
That's a massive project.
But to move away from coal. Yeah. And Europe wants it for the same reason,
right.
Particularly East Europe.
East Europe, because
economies depend on coal.
The economies of the old Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union, as a matter of fact, particularly Western and Southern Soviet Union, were based on coal also. I remember when you'd go there, those forests between Poland and the Baltics and Western Russia, you know, they have the acid rainforests. From the damn, you go through there today, I bet you still see forests that have been dissolved by acid rain, and that was because of the coal.
So without a steady supply of gas, and again, more than a third of it, and that will be ramping up now with Nord Stream 2 coming online supposedly midpoint of next year, it would be impossible for Europe to even come close to thinking about meeting its climate change goals under the Paris Climate Accord and private goals that you know they've set individually for themselves. So these are big deals. And of course, the big thing about this pipeline, why it has met such resistance, is that this will bypass pipelines through Ukraine.
Right.
Now, those pipelines aren't going to go away. They can still be used. There's plenty of excess, but Russia is no longer going to allow its energy relationship with Europe to be held hostage to Ukrainian politics.
Right.
And that's why, despite all of this, wrangling over the civil conflict in Ukraine since the West-backed Maidan putsch, And all the fighting and all the sanction wars and all the name calling and Russian aggressor, that Germany still agreed for this Nord Stream 2 because they know that Russia is a reliable energy supplier, and it has that Russia has never been the problem, neither the Soviet Union nor Russia.
Right.
It has been the intermediary countries, and the transit fees of gas it's basically Russia subsidizing the European, the Ukrainian economy. It's some $3 billion just in transit fees a year that the Ukrainian government is pulling in. Now, to put that into perspective, that is 5% of Ukraine's, almost 5% of Ukraine's GDP, right? Which is some $125 billion. And the Ukrainian government's budget, right, because this is money basically going straight to the budget, is only $40 billion. Their revenues are actually only $35 billion. Their spending is $40 billion, right? And that's, you know, with the IMF and everything on top of, you know, on top of it. But that is a huge portion of their budget that Russia is basically subsidizing. And Russia's saying, no more, or at least not under, you know, cutthroat terms.
Right.
We now have options. We now have choices, and you can't hold our energy relationship. Because this energy relationship, right, everyone's, oh, we can't be dependent. We can't be dependent on Russian energy. This works both ways. It works for both the consumer and the supplier, because the Russian government budget and economy also depends on this energy relationship, right? It is interdependence.
Right.
Now, what Russia is doing, a lot of people are now talking that with this pipeline to China opening, oh, Russia is turning away from Europe, you know, if only, and pivoting to Asia, pivoting to China. Well, actually, if you take a look at it, Russia, yes, is completing this pipeline to China, and it's a big deal.
Right.
And they're completing bridges, road traffic, right? The ties are growing. But they're also building a pipeline to NATO member Turkey, which theoretically is supposed to be extended to Southern Europe someday, but we'll see about that. And then Russia is completing this Nord Stream pipeline to Germany.
Right.
So it's not so much that Russia is pivoting away from Europe to China. They are broadening their options. It
Look
is a multi-vectored, not just an economy, because a pipeline is always more than economics.
Right.
It is geopolitics, because it is a hard energy supply, which is always national security.
Right.
And it is increasing geopolitical connections west, east, and south all at the same time, which is smart.
And north, by the way, because they've been actively developing plans to develop
for the Arctic trade.
Exactly. Yep. So, that's true. meanwhile, while all of this is going on, you mentioned sanctions before. China has actually announced that it is sanctioning Human Rights Watch, the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute, Freedom House, and I think also that the discussions about having the U.S. fleet visit Hong Kong have been basically shut down. You ain't bringing your Navy in here while you're making trouble.
No, the fact that China was hosting a U.S. Navy as tourists when they were just coming off of military drills parading up and down the South China Sea and between the Chinese-Taiwan Straits is always a degree of patience and forbearance that the Chinese government shows that I would certainly never dream. I mean, these tourism visits to Chinese cities of a confrontational navy that is doing saber rattling exercises over the off their coast on the other side of the world is far, far past due.
Yeah.
That is a very mild response.
Yeah, agreed.
China, I think,
but it is interesting that the balance of it. I mean, again, You know, sanctioning Human Rights Watch and the NED, et cetera, is also, we're not talking about multi-billion dollar, you know, activity, but very strong symbolic. And basically, the fact that China is sanctioning the U.S. instead of the U.S. sanctioning somebody else is significant all by itself.
Yeah, that I think that more than anything else, the idea that China dares, you know, like Russia did, dares to sanction the U.S. Right. back is an affront.
Yep.
That they, you know, that they view as some type of injustice.
Yeah, blasphemy almost. Yeah.
Yeah, and what this is over, of course, is that the U.S. Put sanctions on China over protests, which the U.S. certainly had a hand or several hands in stirring up in China,
right.
Protests that are continually presented as pro-democracy.
Right.
But when you take a look at them, are actually nativist and anti-mainland Chinese,
right.
Become quite nationalistic.
Right.
The flying of U.S. and British colonial flags, and
really?
The violence, the radicalization and weaponization of these protests, the daily destruction of Hong Kong's metro stations. I mean, systematic. I mean, they go through,
yep.
They break every electronic turnstile. They smash every marble tile,
yep.
Every glass window.
Yep.
They spike tracks. They literally destroy everything. They are destroying Hong Kong's infrastructure, right, to meet their political demands, which, you know, basically they refuse to admit that they are part of China.
Yeah.
And I regard this as China's big failure.
Mm.
This is a big failure for the Chinese government, because the two systems, one country deal that was worked out has failed. And China's been taken for a ride, because what the terms of the Hong Kong Charter, right, of this agreement that was worked out with this two systems, one government between the
right.
United Kingdom and the Chinese government and Hong Kong when the turnover was made, that foreign powers are not to conduct political activity in Hong Kong.
Right.
that of course, that is exactly what they're doing. And China, through the Hong Kong authorities with their autonomy, has let this happen. And they have let an entire large portion of the next generation of Hong Kong youth been radicalized and weaponized. And it's bad. Just if you watch the videos and you watch the violence and you watch the fanaticism and all of this coming when Hong Kong, according to U.S. think tanks, like the U.S. and European think tanks that put out the Human Freedom Index, the Cato Institute and a European and a British partner, Hong Kong already has somewhere between the first and the third place in world human freedoms already,
right.
Which is like 12 or 13 places higher up the list than the United
yeah,
States.
No kidding.
And higher, still some seven places higher than the United Kingdom.
Right.
So, you know, they say, oh, the U.S. is exploiting the protests, but they have some justification. No, not really. They don't. I mean, this was started over the idea of an extradition treaty to their own country, to China.
That's right.
An extradition treaty between Taiwan, Hong Kong and China. Taiwan, Hong Kong already has an extradition treaty with the United States, but not with their own country.
Right.
China has badly managed. They've basically let this happen. Kind of like the Yanukovych government ignored the buildup of the Banderite battalions training in West Ukraine and let the Maidan develop and build over months into overthrowing his government. This is even in a longer term thing. And I regard it as a big failure. And
yeah.
They really need to take lessons. And, you know, this NGO, banning with these sanctions is a day late and a dollar short. They should have done this a long time ago. And the
right.
U.S. has the temerity in their bill to say that they will review Hong Kong's autonomy. And if it doesn't right. meet their standards, right. they will sanction China more. This is over a Chinese city.
Right. Hey, you know, in that in the legislation that they're talking about, which is what the hell is it called? The Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act of 2019.
Oh, my God.
It starts out. It's the policy of the United States, and then among other things, to support the high degree of autonomy and fundamental rights and freedoms of the people of Hong Kong, as enumerated by, and then they refer to the joint declaration whereby the colonial power Britain gave back Hong Kong to China, which it belonged to. The U.S. policy is to support, you know, to have a wedge, basically, between Hong Kong and, you know, proper relationship, normal relationship with the rest of the country.
Remember the next time the U.S. accuses anyone meddling in their country because of a few Facebook ads.
Hey, yesterday.
I mean, seriously.
Yesterday, or the day before yesterday, there was a warning out of Washington to Russia to stay out of Bolivia.
Out of Bolivia, because that's their hemisphere.
Yeah, it belongs to the United States.
Marco Rubio, the senator who now is supposedly being considered to replace Pompeo as Secretary of State, neocon brat prince, he got on air and it was posted on Twitter as well, and he demanded that China stop meddling in U.S. affairs, because the relationship between the U.S. and the Chinese city of Hong Kong is an internal U.S. matter.
Whoa! Come on.
Because the world is ours.
It's our oyster. It's inside our oyster shell. You know, I'm hoping that Rubio becomes Secretary of State. And then he gets a meeting somewhere with Trump. I'm sorry, with Putin, or someone else around, you know, their age, between Putin's age and Rubio's age, because I remember when Trump was basically calling him out, like, you know, a bravado, calling him out, like, come on, let me slap you around, you little punk. I would just love to see the two of him and Putin in a room, and all of a sudden Putin just reach over and slap him in the back of the head to watch the look on Rubio's face with all the bravado that he exhibits, all the tough guy talk and everything, to watch him cry when somebody did that. Because that's what he is, basically. He's a coward.
He's a piece of work.
That's one way of putting it too.
Miami Cubans. Anyway,
we got about a minute. So how would you encapsulate what's happening, the significance of all of this stuff the last few days in China and Russia?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, I have to thank the Obama administration, previous administrations, the Trump administration, because everything they do, sanctions, trade wars, regime changes again and again, pushes around the world, they keep pushing Russia and China and even Iran closer and closer together.
Yep.
And Russia and China are realizing, with their backs to each other as reliable partners who aren't interested in screwing with each other's stability or political system, that they're better able to confront an aggressive hegemonic West. And these latest linkages are just the latest sign of it. And if you take a look at the headline for the Wall Street Journal today over the issue of this pipeline, right in the sub-headline, this pipeline, a pipeline between Russia and China, somehow challenges U.S. geopolitical and strategic clout and
right.
power. Because the U.S. is a hegemon.
It's all ours. So anybody that has anything else, you've got ours.
Yeah.
Mark, thanks, man. Talk with you again next week.
Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.